Time now for the last word with Zerlina Maxwell, who's in for Lawrence. Good evening, Zerlina.
Thanks, Allie. 1 week before Russia invaded Ukraine, Russian officials arrested American Olympic gold medalist and pro basketball player Brittany Griner. And today, after being detained for 168 days in Russia, the WNBA star was sentenced to 9 years in a Russian prison on charges of possessing and smuggling cannabis. It was nearly the maximum sentence for bringing less than 1 gram of cannabis oil into the country. Brittany Griner pleaded guilty last month to having cannabis-infused vape cartridges in her possession when she arrived in Moscow's airport in February. But she told the court that bringing them into Russia was an honest mistake after she packed in a hurry. Before the sentencing today, an emotional Brittany Griner apologized, saying she never intended to break any laws in a final plea for leniency.
I never meant to hurt anybody. I never meant to put in jeopardy the Russian population. I never meant to break any laws here. I made an honest mistake, and I hope that in your ruling that it doesn't end my life here. I know everybody keeps talking about political pawn and politics, but I hope that that is far from this courtroom.
But the judge didn't grant her any leniency. Her lawyers called the verdict absolutely unreasonable and plan to appeal, saying the court ignored the defense's evidence.
She's very obsessed, very upset, very stressed, and she is, well, she can hardly talk, honestly, so it's a difficult time for her.
President Biden today called the conviction unacceptable and one more reminder of what the world already knew. Russia is wrongfully detaining Brittany. He urged Russia to release her immediately, but vowed his administration would pursue every avenue to secure her release. Today's verdict adding new pressure on the United States to make a deal with Moscow amid tense relations between the two countries over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Biden administration proposed a prisoner swap with Russia back in June to exchange Brittany Griner and detained American businessman Paul Whelan for Russian arms trafficker Victor Boot. But a U.S. official tells NBC News Russia has not responded substantively to that offer, demanding that a Russian spy jailed in Germany for murder be added before they'll agree to the exchange.
We interpreted that the leaks about that from the Russian side as just a bad faith attempt to avoid and cloud up and to sort of distract everybody from what is an actually serious proposal that we made. And we made weeks ago, Andrea. This isn't something that just popped up. I mean, we've been working on this for weeks, and we think this is a bad faith attempt by the Russians, knowing that it's not a serious counteroffer, just to cloud up the waters, make things muddy, and to avoid having to make what is a consequential and serious decision here.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov are set to meet tonight during a trip to Cambodia. But they're actually not expected to talk about a prisoner swap. In a statement earlier, Secretary Blinken emphasized bringing Brittany Griner home was an absolute priority, adding the verdict, quote, puts a spotlight on our significant concerns with Russia's legal system and the Russian government's use of wrongful detentions to advance its own agenda, using individuals as political pawns. U.S. officials are not expecting rapid movement in the effort to get Griner released, but will keep pressing the issue, a U.S. official told NBC News. But her family, her friends, and her teammates, they're not giving up hope. Brittany Griner's WNBA team, the Phoenix Mercury, said in a statement today that they have faith the Biden administration will bring Brittany home, adding, quote, while we knew it was never the legal process that was going to bring our friend home, today's verdict is a sobering milestone in the 168-day nightmare being endured by our sister, BG. We remain grateful to and confident in the public servants working every day to return her to her family and us. Leading off our discussion tonight is Terry Jackson. She's the executive director of the Women's National Basketball Players Association. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Zerlina. I appreciate the time to talk with you and your audience once again.
What's your reaction to today's sentence?
Oh, my goodness. As much as we remind ourselves that this day was coming, as much as we try to prepare, we probably were not prepared. We probably were not ready, not for this. 9 years? For what exactly? Less than 1 gram of cannabis oil? But here's where we are. The verdict was guilty. The sentence was 9 years. There is an urgency in this moment. There's an urgency in now. We must ensure most immediately that BG's health from head to toe, her mental health, her physical health are well supported, because right now, with this verdict, with this sentence, this was a blow. This was a blow to her. We are certain this is a blow to us as we stand by her side, Sherelle, by the side of Sherelle and her family. And we do believe that her mental and physical health, that they're in jeopardy right now. It's just a blow that shakes us to our core. That is our reaction. That's how I would sum it up.
In what ways are you concerned about her mental and physical and even her spiritual health right now?
All of that. Again, you know, we knew this was coming. I mean, in a lot of ways, this was the end of this long road, this process that we needed to see to ensure that the next steps and the legal process still carrying out. We understand from her team that they're going to appeal this. That should happen. We understand that. We support that. And then on the diplomatic side, what needs to be happening across the Biden administration behind the scenes to work to get her rapid release? Because while there are some who may not be expecting that, that's what we are. But in so many ways, just seeing our sister, this beautiful woman, caged, handcuffed. I mean, we don't have to be there to know that she's in jeopardy, and we need to ensure that she's going to be okay. I was thinking about this earlier when asked earlier, you know, what are we hopeful for? We're hopeful that where she will be next will be someplace where her team and Russia can get to her and see her and monitor her. We heard she was poised and showed such composure earlier, but we heard her shaking, right? We hear the struggle. It's real, and we're concerned. We are.
You can really hear in her voice there during her apology today the emotion. When we've talked about this before, recently, when it was announced that there was going to be potentially a prisoner swap, at least the offer was official from the United States government to the Russian government. Are you still hopeful that is a pathway that is possible at this point to get Brittney Griner home and back to her family and friends safely?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I'm hopeful for that. Absolutely, that's my expectation. You know, we understand that this is a very real, very serious geopolitical situation. And I'm a strong believer in that words matter. And so I look to choose my words very carefully. But it's telling to us that this administration uses language like, there never should have been a trial, that she is wrongfully detained. She and Paul Whelan are wrongfully detained. It is telling that the administration shared very publicly that it has offered what they call a substantial proposal, and that a substantial proposal is on the table. So we're hopeful. Absolutely. We remain hopeful. You know, somebody asked me a little earlier, you know, what's next? What does it look like? Momentum has intensified across women's basketball. At least that's what I said. That was my prediction. It will intensify mm-hmm. across the women's basketball community. It will continue to build across the global sports community and human rights organizations. And that's exactly what is happening. In the minutes, in the you know, hours after we heard the verdict and the sentence, there was an outpouring of support. And so my expectation is that will continue. My expectation is that the Biden administration will hear the noise, feel the noise and the pressure and the support from us and our allies, and will continue to press on. I don't know if folks saw it earlier. Your members of your audience saw, you know, the games, the WNBA games, the Phoenix Sun. I'm sorry, the Phoenix Mercury and the Connecticut Sun played a game. And before that game, they met at center court and had a very powerful moment for 42 seconds. BG's jersey number. The Dallas Wings and the Las Vegas Aces had the same powerful moment before their game. We will not stop until we see our sister come home.
I'm not going to stop talking about it until I see BG home. It's sad to see the season games start without an eight-time All-Star. If that were happening in any other league, I can't even imagine. But she has the support of her league and her teammates and her family and you. And I'm so grateful to you for starting us off tonight. Thank you so much, Terry Jackson, for being here. Please stay safe. Joining us now is Joe Cirincione, nuclear and national security expert and former staff member of the House Armed Services Committee. Brittany's agent released this statement earlier today saying, today's sentencing of Brittany Griner was severe by Russian legal standards and goes to prove what we have known all along, that Brittany is being used as a political pawn. So, Joe, we've talked previously about the potential for this severe sentencing. It's 9 years in a penal colony. Can you tell us what that actually means? I'm not actually familiar with what a penal colony in Russia is actually like. Tell us.
Most of the prisons in Russia actually are penal colonies, over 600 of them. They evolved from Joe Stalin's forced labor camps. Prisoners there no longer have to break rocks, do mining, but they do manual labor, making uniforms, for example. It is a harsh environment, but not a brutal one. They do get decent food, and there's a fair amount of accessibility to them. They are harassed by guards, so Brittany Griner can expect to have the guards there harassing her, trying to provoke her, perhaps to commit camp infractions that can be used to increase her sentence or at least deny her parole. So this is not in any way going to be a pleasant stay for Brittany Griner. The longer she is there, the harsher it's likely to get.
Which is why you heard Terry talking about the urgency that so many of her family and friends and teammates have, putting pressure and attention on the Biden administration to speed this up. We've talked about the potential for a prisoner swap, the Nicolas Cage character in Lord of War. What Russia has proposed on their side is they've added another prisoner, and that's a Russian jailed for murder in Germany. John Kirby said today that he wouldn't go so far as even to call it a counteroffer. What is your take on that development in light of the official offer we made to swap her and Paul Whelan for Victor Boot?
Right. Completely predictable. This is Putin's game. She's not just a political pawn. She's a hostage. You know, when she walked through that Moscow airport, she didn't know Putin was about to invade Ukraine, but Putin did. And he wanted some chips to play with. And in this case, he scored a major hostage. And the sentence today, this 9-year sentence for a trace amount of cannabis, about 1/10 the amount of cannabis you would find in an everyday edible that people can buy here in Massachusetts legally over the counter. This is an outrageous sentence. And the purpose of that sentence is to increase the value of Brittany Griner and to make her more valuable for exactly the kind of swap that Putin has in mind. In particular, he has his eyes on Victor Boot, a notorious arms merchant serving about 11 years so far in his 25-year sentence for arms smuggling, a close contact of Putin. I wouldn't be surprised if Putin or the Russian government, at least, had cooperated with the smuggling operations of Victor Boot. He wants him out. He is the highest ranking, the most prestigious Russian prisoner held by U.S. Prisons. And now he's playing a game. Can he get more than Victor Boot? Can he get some of his other close contacts released? Can he play this game well enough to trade her and maybe Paul Whelan for 2-3 prisoners? That's why I wouldn't expect an early end to this drama. I would expect this to play out for several more months at least.
Joe Cirincione, thank you so much for your expertise. Please stay safe. We have some breaking election news. NBC News projects Carrie Lake has won the Republican nomination for governor in Arizona. The Trump-endorsed election denier will take on Democrat Katie Hobbs in November. Coming up, former Attorney General Eric Holder goes there, saying the words Donald Trump does not want to hear together in a single sentence. Former president and indicted. You'll hear it coming up next. And later on in the show, conservatives welcome an autocrat to their convention. And then they give him a standing ovation. Stay with us. Breaking news in the Justice Department's grand jury investigation into Donald Trump's actions during the lead up to the January 6th insurrection. CNN is reporting that former President Trump's legal team is in communication with the DOJ. According to CNN, the conversations are, quote, focused mostly on whether any communications that witnesses from the Trump West Wing had with the former president can be kept from a federal criminal grand jury under Trump's claims of executive privilege. Concerns among Team Trump over executive privilege likely spiked when it was reported last week that two of former Vice President Mike Pence's top aides had already appeared before the federal grand jury. Both Pence aides were present at a series of meetings in the lead up to the January 6th attack where Donald Trump and his attorney, John Eastman, tried to get the vice president to go along with their plan to reject Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. During the meetings, Eastman admitted that his plan would lose 9-0 at the Supreme Court. And earlier this year, a federal judge concluded that Trump and Eastman likely committed crimes in their attempts to overturn the election. Now, despite all of that, and despite Trump's legal teams reportedly warning him that indictments from the federal grand jury are actually possible, CNN is reporting today that the former president has expressed a heavy dose of skepticism that he will be indicted, one of the sources familiar with the matter said. Trump may not want to believe his attorneys, but they certainly are not alone in their opinion that an indictment could be coming. Here's what former Attorney General Eric Holder told my SiriusXM colleague, Joe Madison.
I think that what's going to happen here is that more evidence is going to be elicited. You will see people start to cut deals. My guess is that by the end of this process, you're going to see indictments involving high-level people in the White House. You're going to see indictments against people outside the White House who were advising them with regard to the attempt to steal the election. And I think ultimately you're probably going to see the president, former president of the United States, indicted as well.
Joining us now, Jill Weinbanks, who served as an assistant Watergate prosecutor. She's an MSNBC legal analyst. We're also joined by Tim O'Brien, senior executive editor for Bloomberg Opinion and author of Trump Nation. He is an MSNBC political analyst. Jill, let me get your reaction to this new reporting that Trump's legal team is talking to the Department of Justice officials over issues of executive privilege. How would you expect these conversations to go, especially considering that since Trump isn't the president anymore, he doesn't really have a claim of executive privilege any longer?
There is a very long list, Zerlina, of reasons why those conversations will go nowhere. The Department of Justice has all the cards in this. You have U.S. v. Nixon from the Watergate era, which basically said grand jury need trumps anything else. And I use that word carefully. I meant it. It is that starts it. But here's a case where it's the former president. And we know that the current president is not invoking the privilege. We know there's a crime fraud exception. And this would certainly involve crime fraud. So I think on every possible ground, there will be no privilege allowed to anyone. So it's going to be a bad day. There's a lot of people who are going to be coming in. I think your introduction is absolutely correct. Once you start getting people like Cassidy Hutchinson testifying, and then you start subpoenaing Pat Cipollone and Philbin and others, many others are going to realize that the best deals they can get are the sooner they get in, And so they're going to start coming in and they're going to want to testify. They will also feel supported by the group action. So I think there's going to be a lot of testimony that will make even clearer than what was shown us in the January 6th hearings, which I think was very clear. I think we're going to see a lot more and that there will be enough for indictments on any one of the many tentacles of this big conspiracy.
And Tim, I mentioned that the president's reaction to this news was like basically Kanye shrug. I mean, essentially, he doesn't care because he's concerned about the 2022 midterms and running for president again. I want to read you this reporting from CNN. It says, one person close to Trump said he is noticeably more engaged when he is chatting with friends and advisors about the 2022 midterms and his possible presidential campaign in 2024 than he is during briefings on legal strategy. This person described the former president as dismissive in conversations about his legal troubles, often repeating his witch hunt mantra, as he claims the various probes he's facing are plainly driven by political opponents. So, Tim, does it sound to you at all like he's hoping to hide from this investigation and potential criminal liability by running for president again?
Well, Zerlina, I wanna steal that line of a Kanye shrug from you. I'm gonna use that going forward from now on. I think another version of that is that he puts a reality distortion field around himself when he doesn't like the circumstances that are staring him right in the face. He's done it for decades. When he's been behind the eight ball in business, when he has been the subject of public criticism, when he's been subject to prior investigations before. He pretends that he disdains them, but this is easily the most serious investigation that's ever landed at his doorstep. The consequences are monumental. And if he doesn't think this is going to get close to him now, he's simply fooling himself. And of course, he thinks that if he runs for the presidency again, that may offer him a measure of protection. I think keeping his name in play for 2024 has other attractions to him. He's essentially a media addict, so it guarantees that people will continue to pay attention to him. He's been able to monetize his post-presidency. He's raising money off of gullible contributors. That's attractive to him. But I also think at the end of the day that he thinks that the presidency will shield him from prosecution. And that's why this moment is so deeply important historically and legally, because the system, our constitution, our country, has to show that no one is above the law, including the president. And I think that the Justice Department has finally shown evidence, public evidence, that they're doing more than just sniffing around this. They are starting to take concrete prosecutorial action that looks like it will lead toward an indictment. I don't think the issue anymore is whether or not Donald Trump committed a crime. And it appears the issue no longer is whether or not the DOJ will take action. It's whether or not Garland can bring this into a courtroom and convict a former president of a crime. And that'll get into issues around the jury pool and those sorts of things. But those are atmospheric and strategic. They're not legal and institutional. And I think that the fact that the DOJ is pounding on Trump's doorstep is very, very important.
That's a really important point, Tim. I think people talk way too much about all of the political implications and a backlash. I'm like, just talk about the law and the facts. And then we can decide whether to prosecute based on that. The other stuff is all ancillary. It's not really noise. As important as the facts and the law. It's noise, exactly. Jill Weinbanks and Tim O'Brien, thank you so much for being here. Please stay safe. First, Republicans found their love of autocrats when Donald Trump embraced Vladimir Putin and the GOP followed. Now today, Tucker Carlson's favorite autocrat, Hungary's Viktor Orban, who recently condemned mixed-race societies, is being embraced by conservatives at CPAC. That's next. Today, a room full of Republicans gave Hungary's authoritarian leader, Viktor Orban, a standing ovation for saying this.
Family ties shall be based on marriage or the relationship between parents and children. To sum up, the mother is a woman, the father is a man, and leave our kids alone. Full stop, end of discussion.
Conservatives welcome Viktor Orban's racist, anti-immigrant, and anti-LGBTQ rhetoric with open arms at CPAC in Dallas, Texas, where he kicked off the conservative conference, giving a 30-minute speech titled, How We Fight. Orban has become a familiar face to conservatives and Fox News viewers ever since Tucker Carlson traveled all the way to Hungary to interview the Hungarian prime minister and to help spread his ultra-nationalist views. Orban's speech at CPAC comes nearly 2 weeks after saying, quote, This is why we have always fought. We are willing to mix with one another, but we do not want to become peoples of mixed race. And that speech led one of Orban's closest advisors to write that this speech was, quote, pure Nazi, adding, quote, I don't know how you didn't notice that your speech you delivered is purely Nazi diatribe worthy of Joseph Goebbels. Just days later, Donald Trump welcomed Viktor Orban to his New Jersey golf course, calling him a friend. Joining us now is Peter Beinart, professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. He's also an MSNBC political analyst. So, Peter, Ruth Benyad, expert on strongmen, writes, quote, Orban's embrace of ethno-nationalism, hungry for the Hungarians, anti-Semitism anchored in his obsession with destroying his former friend George Soros, and defense of Christendom and white European heritage have made him a beacon of the far right and Budapest into a hub for a new generation of extremists. So have his, quote, pro-family and anti-LGBTQ plus policies. And back in 2018, he banned gender studies from higher education, and in 2020 ended the legal recognition of transgender and intersex people. And today, Viktor Orban said this.
Progressive liberals didn't want me to be here because they knew what I would tell you. Because I'm here to tell you that we should unite our forces.
So where are we right now in the Republican Party? What does it say that they are willing to align themselves with Viktor Orban and this rhetoric? And what does it say about the state of the party in 2022 post-insurrection?
It says that the party is less conservative than it is just white Christian nationalist. It's interesting. This is the Conservative Political Action Committee. There are other conservative leaders around the world. South Korea is a more important country than Hungary. They just elected a very conservative government, pro-business, small taxes, hawkish. These guys could have thought of inviting Volodymyr Zelensky, right? I mean, you talk about someone who embodies supposed conservative values, defending your country, defending its sovereignty. No, they went to the leader of Hungary, not that important country. Why? Because Orban represents white Christian nationalist values. The values are, if you are not white and Christian, we will keep you out of our country. And if you do happen to be in our country, you will be legally subordinate, just as you will be if you're a woman or if you're LGBTQ. That is the vision that the CPAC and much of the Republican Party wants in the United States.
One of the things I don't necessarily understand, Peter, is how the relationship is beneficial to Viktor Orban within his country. Like, why is he palling around with media figures on the conservative right? Does that boost his influence within his own country?
Well, look, Orban is I think that Hungary is the 17th largest economy just in Europe. Right? Orban, Hungary is not a very powerful country. So I think what this gives Orban is the ability to feel like he's a global leader who's shaping things in the United States, the most powerful country in the world. And remember, there is not a free political system in Hungary now. He has done to the Hungarian political system what Donald Trump is trying to do to the American political system. So whether what he's doing is particularly popular in Hungary or not, he doesn't have to worry about it all that much because he's rigged the rules of the game, just like so many Republicans are trying to do here.
That is a really helpful explanation, because before the segment, I was like, I don't understand why this is a bromance. Peter Beinart, thank you so much for helping us understand it. Please stay safe. Coming up, we'll have more on the conservatives' embrace of Hungary's autocratic leader at CPAC for saying things like this.
Hungary shall protect the institution of marriage as the union of one man and one woman. The mother is a woman. The father is a man. My government is devoted to law and order without compromise. We decided we don't need more genders, we need more rangers. Less drag queens and more Chuck Norris.
Kurt Bardella and Christina Greer, join us next.
I am an old-fashioned freedom fighter. We have to be brave enough to address even the most sensitive questions: migration, gender, and the clash of civilizations. Don't worry, a Christian politician cannot be racist. Politics, my friend, are not enough. This war is a culture war.
This is what Donald Trump has wrought in modern American politics. And we've known this since he first became a candidate, when the official newspaper of the Ku Klux Klan endorsed him for president because of his endless attacks on immigrants. We saw it in 2017, when President Donald Trump called the white supremacists in Charlottesville very fine people. Donald Trump's embrace of racism and the racist idea of white replacement has motivated the conservative base of the Republican Party. In many ways, Donald Trump normalized racism, and the Republican Party has embraced it and continued to cultivate it with their rhetoric and policies. And that's why we saw Confederate flags at the Capitol on January 6th. And that's why we saw members of the Trump mob wearing Camp Auschwitz t-shirts at the Capitol attack. And that's why we saw mass murders in Pittsburgh, El Paso, and 3 months ago in Buffalo, New York, where the suspects left screeds about white replacement. Politicians like Donald Trump and Viktor Orban are stoking this kind of existential animus towards anyone who isn't white or Christian, and conservatives, they're eating it up. Joining us now, Kurt Bardella, advisor to the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Also, Professor Christina Greer, associate professor of political science at Fordham University. So, Kurt, why is the question I have? Why do conservatives embrace these types of dictators?
Because they're the role models at this point, Jillian. I mean, they're not really trying to hide this at this point, that they look at these autocrats, these dictator-like people, these white supremacist leaders as role models. That's what they're trying to remake this country. When they say, let's make America great again, what they mean by that is to take us back to a place where people who look like you and me are devalued, where people are not seen as equal, where women don't have the same rights, where people of color are less than their white counterparts. That's what they mean by going back. And they're not even trying to hide it. When you give a standing ovation at a major political conference to someone like this, you might as well just, you're basically taking your hood off for everybody to see this is who you are. And they're being very, very blunt about it. And I think it's time that when we talk about the Republican Party, we cannot divorce them now from the white nationalist racist elements that are overrunning them.
Christina, do you think this is a consequence of basically Donald Trump normalizing racism and bigotry and just making it perfectly okay and acceptable in mainstream spaces to be overtly racist?
Absolutely, Zerlina. He excavated what has always been a factor in this country. Don't forget, I mean, we are founded on white supremacy and anti-black racism, capitalism, and patriarchy, as bell hooks has always told us. And so what Donald Trump has done is just brought it to the surface and made it okay for people to say, you know what, actually, I don't want actually people of color in my schools and my neighborhoods. I don't want women, as leaders. And, you know, there's so many mediocre people who have been able to excel in this country for centuries. And now that there's a modicum of competition, now it all of a sudden seems like inequity. And so Donald Trump has made it such that this is, the party of victimhood. This is the party of people who feel as though they're aggrieved. And so as he has people marching in Charlottesville and says they're very fine people, we must remember that this is a man who came down a gold-plated escalator and said that Mexicans were rapists. And there were, 75 million people who were just fine to vote for him to say, oh, it's the tax breaks. I don't really think the racism is real. Well, it's actually real. And we've seen it time and time again. We've had enough years and enough instances of Donald Trump and his ilk doubling down on racism and white supremacy. So if you are a Republican, you can no longer hide behind the tax breaks. You are in for a penny and in for a pound, and you now support the party of white supremacists. That's plain and simple. That's where we are.
Yeah, I don't know where we got this idea that if you vote for a candidate that says racist things, that somehow you don't own that. You don't get to accept any responsibility for that decision that you made to support that person. And Kurt, to that point Christina just made about the changing demographics and the feeling that some white Americans have that they're losing something, in his book, A Way Out of No Way, excuse me, Senator Raphael Warnock writes, the former president's continued claims of widespread voter fraud are just his way of saying that the votes of certain people don't count, can't count, and can't be real because the election outcome was not consistent with the myth of white supremacy. So, Kurt, talk about that. Talk about the fact that basically this is a result of the changing demographics and the fact that white voters eventually will be a minority of the voters.
You know, towards the end of the Obama administration, the Census Bureau came out and said that by 2035, we're going to be a minority-majority country in this country. And that really terrified the Republican Party. They realized that their years of attacking minorities, their years of anti-immigrant policies, their years of suppressing and demoralizing anyone who didn't look like them, that was an electoral defeat that was going to be baked into the demographics. So they came up with a plan, and that plan was very simple. What if we don't let those people vote? What if we make it harder for them to vote? What if we do everything we can to discourage them from participating in the democratic process? Because they know that when the playing field is equal and all things are level, they lose. They lost in 2018. They lost in 2020. They lost in the Georgia special election. So what did they do after having the most fair and the most open and the most recounted election in recent memory? They went out and passed a bunch of anti-voter suppression laws. They went out and made it harder for people to participate in the democratic process. And the people that they made it harder for, they weren't the white people. They were people who looked like you and me. There are people that they're trying to disenfranchise and make sure that they don't get to participate in the process. That's why I say over and over again, this November election, this midterm election could very well be the last free and fair election we have in America.
Christina, in terms of marginalizing these voices, how do we go about doing that? How do you remove the racists, the bigots, the xenophobes, the folks that are espousing this type of rhetoric from our mainstream political space and conversations?
Selena, I'm not exactly sure because, you know, if we build on what Kurt has just said, we also realize that, you know, you don't need white people for white supremacy anymore. The same way you don't need, you know, just men to have patriarchy. We see women uphold it quite well, paging Amy Coney Barrett and her friends. So, you know, what the Republicans have been brilliant at doing is not only disenfranchising people of color and marginalized groups across the country, but they're really starting to, you know, use their white supremacist rhetoric and chip away at certain Latino, Asian, and Black populations across the country. We're seeing, you know, Latinos in Arizona and Texas, Asians in New York, Black folks in the South, you know, voting in, you know, pockets, but in particular elections with the Republican Party because they're buying into this isolationist rhetoric. They're buying into this nationalist rhetoric that means something for someone else means that it's taking away from something from you. And that is actually what's the most dangerous part of the Republican Party right now.
Kurt Bardella and Professor Christina Greer, thank you so much for being here tonight. Please stay safe. Coming up, are we seeing the start of a second simultaneous pandemic? The truth about monkeypox and what you need to know about the virus. That's up next. The country and really the entire world is now living with two simultaneous pandemics. Today, the White House declared the monkeypox outbreak a public health emergency in the United States. The move comes almost 2 weeks after the World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global health emergency. And in practical terms, the declaration of a public health emergency frees up government resources to make vaccines, testing, and treatment more available. Health officials in New York, California, and over in Illinois declared states of emergency earlier this week, and many health experts are wondering, what took the White House so long for their declaration? Administration officials acknowledge they are now playing a little bit of catch up as case numbers grow faster than they initially expected. According to an NBC News analysis of CDC data, the 7-day average of reported new cases increased from 45 on July the 11th to 214 just 2 weeks later. And joining us now to discuss, Dr. Syra Madad, an infectious disease epidemiologist and senior director of the Special Pathogens Program at the New York City Health and Hospitals System. So, Dr. Madad, tell us what we need to know about monkeypox. I think there's a lot of confusion about how it spreads, who can be infected with monkeypox. So break it down for us.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Certainly, you know, with today's news, I'm sure all Americans are trying to figure out, well, what is the threat to me? And so I think first it's important to understand that monkeypox is circulating in many communities in the United States. We're seeing, you know, as you've seen, as you just projected, you know, doubling of cases in a little over a week's time. Just imagine, you know, in 3 days, we've seen over 1,000 cases. So this virus is certainly circulating in our communities. And what we're seeing in terms of the epidemiological data is that majority of these cases, A, are being reported in individuals that, are male. When we look at additional risk factors, they are men who have sex with men and have multiple sexual partners. And right now, transmission is largely being driven by skin-to-skin contact or intimate contact. So through anal and oral sex, through kissing, hugging, massaging with individuals that are infected. But there are other modes of transmission of monkeypox. And this can include, you know, non-direct contact with these lesions. So through contaminated objects, through droplet, respiratory secretions in close prolonged contact. So these are less defined ways of how this virus is transmitting, but majority is being driven by, skin to skin contact through sexual, sexual activities.
So in terms of transmission, that also includes fomites, right? Touching things. So help us understand what are the steps of mitigation we need in the last few minutes here to protect ourselves from monkeypox. Are they the same as COVID?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So first, monkeypox and COVID are two very different viruses and require two very different responses, if you will. So basic foundation is the same when it comes to outbreak response. But when we talk about fomite transmission, especially with monkeypox, certainly there is a theoretical risk, but a lot needs to happen. So an infectious individual has to obviously be touching, you know, a surface, contaminating it. Another person that's not infected picks up that virus. But even if you pick up the virus, you need to have enough viral dose to cause infection. And then you also have to have an opening where this virus can get into. And it has to be a replicating and live virus. So certainly it's a possibility, but that is not what's driving this epidemic that we're seeing certainly here in the United States and in many countries that are reporting this cases.
Really helpful to understand all of that. Dr. Seyermadad, thank you so much for your time tonight. That's tonight's last word.